Julian, good morning.
Good morning, Sean. How are you doing?
Yeah, very well. Thanks, mate. Thanks for joining us here on The Daily. Now, China's current stance in the South China Sea, literally building islands out of nowhere in order to lay claim to important trade routes which fall under other countries' jurisdiction. How does the white paper address this?
Well, the Australian government has always had an ambiguous position on China's seemingly aggressive manoeuvres in the South China Sea, and also I should mention in the East China Sea as well. And the Australian government doesn't take any position on claimants to these reefs and atolls and rocks and so on that the Chinese have been building on. But as you said before, the role of national security and defence is to hope for the best, but always make sure that you can prepare for the worst. And the Defence White Paper appears to be pushing for a substantial increase in Australian defence budgets that are very much aimed at sending signals to China to basically say, well, we realise that you are starting to attempt to change the rules of international behaviour in the Asia-Pacific. It seems like you're starting to try and push your way against other neighbouring countries and also regional organisations. And we're not going to sit by and allow that to happen. We're going to increase our defence spending. We're going to make sure our defence infrastructure is interoperational with the Americans. And we're going to make a stand.
Well, some commentators have said that Australia is showing its hand, and the reaction in the Chinese media has been almost ropeable at times, saying Australia has a Cold War mentality. What does the paper mean for Australian-Chinese relations more diplomatically?
Well, you remember this has happened before. So back in 2009, Australia produced a defence white paper under the Rudd government, which was also very, very assertive in regards to the potential for China as it rises economically and militarily to become a revisionist power, in the sense it starts to try and change the rules of the region to suit itself, and in doing so starts to sort of impinge on the rights and the freedoms of the countries around it. And at that time, Beijing was ropeable as well, extremely ropeable. However, we saw in the post-2009 world Australia's trading relationship with China continued, and also it must be said that Australia actually never followed through on any of the real commitments to that particular white paper, partly because of the change in government we had shortly afterwards, from Rudd to Gillard. So yes, China is saying a lot of things, that Australia is acting in a Cold War mentality, we're being confrontational, we're artificially framing this issue as a decision between an American order and a Chinese order, whereas everyone can live happily together and so on. But we've seen that sort of rhetoric from China for a long time. And what's changed now, I think, in 2016 as opposed to 2009, is that it's very obvious to defence planners that this Chinese rhetoric is really hiding or covering a very large stick that China is wielding, and it is being very assertive and one would say almost belligerent in its neighbourhood. So really, I don't think the Australian defence planners have much of a choice. It's either roll over and send a signal to China that we're not going to contest their rise and their assertiveness, or muscle up and tell them that they're not going to get away with it that easily, is the subtext.
Well, it's quite funny you mentioned that sort of happy ending idea, because Australia is still essentially maybe a mid-sized tuna amongst two very big sharks, the US and China. Diplomatically, we've maintained a pretty good relationship, pretty good position with both, but some are saying our future strategy does depend on a happy ending in the South China Sea, where China backs down and relations between the superpowers stay cool. Militarily, defence-wise, is there really anything we can feasibly do to improve our situation of a worst-case scenario anyway?
Well, there's nothing that Australia can do to confront China militarily, and no one in Australia wants to do that. No one in Australian military circles or government circles wants there to be any form of conflict or confrontation between either China and America or China and Australia militarily. And largely this defence rise in expenditure is about, well, one, hedging your bets, which is the stability of Australia's politicians and defence forces to make sure that we are able to defend ourselves in case things do become the worst possible scenario. But it's also about sending signals, as I mentioned before. Now, this issue about the happy ending is much bigger than Australia. What we're seeing in East Asia has massive historical implications. We're really looking at a transition from a European and then later American world order, which has really been going around now for about 300 years or so, the era of colonization and such, when the great civilizations of China and India were laid low because of the technological superiority of the West. What we're actually seeing right now is a transition back to the way the world was 300 years before, when large, populous, technologically advanced societies like China were the most prosperous and the largest and the most powerful societies on Earth. And the West or Europe was really an afterthought for much of that. And so we're looking at China's population. It has expanded hugely. They've now industrialized. That population is becoming more productive. China is becoming wealthier. As it becomes wealthier, it's becoming more powerful. And historically, countries that become more powerful begin to carve out a series of rules in the international context that suit themselves. And so we're looking at a situation where America, who is the dominant and has been for some time power in the Asia-Pacific, has a bit of a conundrum to face. What does it do? Can it find a way to share a balance of power with China in the region? Or does it leave the region to China and allow China to sort of become a hegemon, we call them, in the Asia-Pacific, as it has been in the past through much of its history? Or does America make a stand and confront China and sort of push back? And so historically, when you look at times when one great power has been replaced by another great power, sort of looking from the Portuguese to the Spanish, or the Dutch to the French, or the French to the British, and so on, often in history you see that these powers make the decision to stand up and to make a stand, and that unfortunately historically often leads to conflict and war. And so we have to be very careful about this bigger picture, and be very, very, very careful about what we think a happy ending actually looks like in this region, not just next year or in 5 years, but we're looking 30, 50 years, 100 years down the track, where no matter what government is ruling in Beijing, China will be, almost certainly, the most powerful, most prosperous, and most assertive country in our part of the world.
Now, just finally, Julian, completely off this topic of China and the white paper, but did want to touch on this before we go, but maybe a bonus round question, I guess. That case over in the United States where the FBI has been seeking Apple's help in unlocking the iPhone of one of the San Bernardino suspects. Apple's refused.
Yes, they've actually taken, or they've taken Apple to court to try and force Apple to allow them to break into the iPhone.
What are your feelings on this one?
Well, this is a classic example of governmental short-sightedness and overreach in regards to national security against the security of individuals to have privacy and freedom. And so what we see here is Apple has designed the hardware and software of its phones quite deliberately so that they are not easily hackable. So governments and others, including Apple itself, it must be said, can't just get into them through some sort of back door. The FBI essentially are asking them, well, you need to provide us with a back door. We promise we'll only use it this once. We really want to just find out what this terrorist attacker from the San Bernardino attack has in his phone. And Apple's saying, no, this will create a precedent. You won't do it once, you'll do it many times afterwards. There'll be many national security issues where law enforcement will want to get into people's individual privacy. And also, must be said, Apple's also saying, and if we do it for you, then we're doing it for everyone. What about people who own iPhones in countries that have repressive regimes? What about all the iPhone owners in China when the Chinese government starts to want to hack into the back door there? And so they're putting up a stand and saying, we're not going to do it. They're saying they're doing it for freedom and sort of high-minded values, but they're also doing it because this is obviously what their market wants and what individuals want. And so it's an interesting example of a private company actually standing up for individual freedoms as opposed to a government which is really looking to roll them back because of national security. And that private company's doing it, it seems, because it realizes that that its market expects that of it. So it's a very interesting dynamic being played out, and my bets in this case are on Apple winning.
Well, really drawing a line in the sand there. Julian, thank you very much, mate. Do appreciate your time coming on this morning.
Pleasure,
having a bit of a chat with us.